Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of September. We have a full 2 hours on healthcare today. We're going to be looking at global trends such as immigration, travel, trade, and shifting disease patterns and how they have an impact on the health of the people in Wisconsin. We have a fascinating guest who will join us in just one moment. Second hour of our program, you've probably heard a lot about this book. It's gained critical reviews and is all over the national press. It was the front page of the New York Times book review section yesterday, in case you want to read that before we talk with one of the co-authors of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. And the authors of this book have traced the healthcare policies and thoughts of all the presidents since FDR. It's a fascinating book, 75 years of what presidents have thought and what they've tried to do for health care in this country. So that should be good. You're welcome to join our conversation all 2 hours. And the way to do that is to give us a call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Cynthia Hawk is our guest, director of the Center for Global Health, professor of family medicine and population sciences at the UW Medical School of Medicine and Public Health. She's focused her career on primary health care. She has worked all over the world, trained village health workers in Uganda, established family medicine training in Pakistan, served as a consultant to the World Health Organization, and work to improve medical education in this country and in other countries. She's also leading an urban health track for UW medical students. She practices in Madison and in Milwaukee. For 19 years, she's practiced in Belleville, Wisconsin, a town with less than 2,000 people, 20 miles outside Madison. And she spends a good deal of time in very different locales. We're very happy to have Dr. Cynthia Hawk with us this hour. Professor Hawk, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell me why you consider yourself, because you have an interesting background and what you do is perfect for what your background is. Your story, you say, is one of globalization.
Well, I think I was born into the job that I've found. My father came from India and my mother from rural Indiana. And so I grew up between Indiana and Pakistan as a child, and saw the contrast of different conditions around the world and also the impact of these conditions on people's lives and their health. And so I was then naturally attracted to working in a way that I might be able to bridge the gaps and teach and learn about health around the world.
You have this fairly profound thought when you were 7 years old, passing poor children on the streets of your hometown of Lahore, Pakistan, and wondering why they often did not have food and she did.
Well, yes, this was a moment emblazoned in my memory when many who've had the chance to travel to less economically developed countries have seen the throngs of beggars that can join. And when I was a little girl, I remember a moment in which our car was surrounded by children, and the children looked a lot like me, except for the fact that they weren't wearing proper clothes. They were obviously malnourished. Many of them had sores on their skin, and they were literally begging for money or hopefully for food and clothing. And I asked my mother, why was that the condition for them, and what about me? And she made the comment, there but for the grace of God goes you. Mm-hmm. And I think that really I became internalized in terms of thinking about how did I get so lucky and how could I use my good fortune perhaps to make things a bit better for those who were less fortunate than myself. And so that then became a theme of the work I've done through my life.
You certainly have. You look at comparisons here, and I know you've worked all over the world, but some of what I've read about you and the statistics that you cite are quite striking. I know you spent quite a bit of time working in Uganda, and I'd like to talk to you about how that came about. But you discuss the fact that all of Uganda had 2,000 doctors, and there are 2,000 doctors in Madison, Wisconsin.
That's correct. And the World Health Organization has recommended that there should be a minimum of 3 health workers. That's nurses, medical assistants, laboratory, and doctors per every 1 to 3,000 people. So that's the minimum ratio we know is needed to deliver basic health care services for everyone. But virtually the entire continent, well, sub-Saharan Africa, does not reach that bare minimum in terms of health workers. And there are many other parts of the world as well, certainly Afghanistan, many parts of Central Asia. You simply don't have sufficient numbers of health professionals to deliver health care services, because you can't have a health system without health workers who have been trained to deliver the care. Doesn't matter how much technology or drugs you have, if you don't have people who know what they're doing, who know how to use these technologies and drugs, they're to no avail. So there's an issue of a minimum number of health workers, and then also health workers that are trained to do the job well and trained for the condition and the culture and the circumstances that they're working in. So that's been another major thrust of my professional work, is how to design curriculum that really prepares health workers to do the job necessary to promote health, preserve health, and keep the population as healthy as possible.
And it's not just the workers, it's also the water, it's also the food. It's striking how people have to walk such long distances to be able to get water that will not make them sick.
Absolutely. And interestingly, while the country of the United States is so focused on health care reform, we know that when we look at the determinants of health, that is, what makes you or me healthy or unhealthy, it turns out that access to health care services, medical care, probably determines somewhere between 10 and 20% of health outcomes. So the vast majority of one's health is not how many times you go to the doctor or the hospital, but it's how you live your daily life. The water you drink, the air you breathe, how much you exercise, what you eat. All of these decisions that each of us make on a day-to-day basis, but also are largely determined by the environment that we're in. And so quite a bit of our health is what we call socially determined. It's determined by the social conditions around us. And so health care services are only a small part of what actually impacts health outcomes.
And I know when you take students in the field, which you've done in Thailand, in Mexico, Ecuador, Uganda, the students are looking at animals as well. You take veterinarians with you as well, which I think is interesting. But they're looking at the whole. They're also looking at water supplies in addition to access to care and to teaching about care.
Absolutely. And those of us who live in the United States take for granted that we can go to the sink and turn on the water and get a glass of water and actually drink it. And in much of the world, this is not the case. So when we take students in the field, we are looking at everything from the engineering of the roads to the quality of the water, the air, the way people live or don't live with animals, their access to food. And so students come back to the United States realizing that these conditions are also important. And as we work as health professionals, part of our job is to take care of people who are sick. But I believe another important part of the health worker is to help create a society that's healthier for everyone, to actually keep people from coming to the doctor because they don't need to as much.
Right.
Exactly.
In Thailand, you say students that you take to Thailand are looking at the public health infrastructure. For a fraction of the money we spend here, the health outcomes there are almost as good. What kind of health outcomes are you measuring?
Well, some of the very basic measures are longevity, how long do people live? And then there's another more complex measure called disability-adjusted life years. How long do people live, but how many of them are disabled, and how badly are they disabled? And if you look at the health, these very basic measures of health outcomes, there's strikingly a small amount of difference between Thailand and the United States, despite the fact that the average person in Thailand earns a fraction, less than 10% of what the average American earns. Why are the health outcomes so good in Thailand? Well, it's because the government of Thailand has decided to invest very strongly in basic public health measures, access to clean water, sufficient food, immunizations. They've really worked hard on organizing village health committees so people are educated about how to stay healthy, how to exercise, how to avoid HIV/AIDS, for instance. And so there are these very basic low-cost investments that a society can make that have major payoffs in the long run in terms of the overall health and well-being. And not only is health important for the individual, we know it really has a dramatic impact on the society as a whole, because a healthier society tends to be more productive, more economically sound, and less vulnerable to all sorts of problems that wreak havoc in a community or society.
So they have, and perhaps we don't have as we debate health care in this country right now, a kind of moral commitment to making sure that citizens, all citizens, are healthy?
That's correct. And while we have a public health system in the United States, it's relatively weak compared to many other countries. We have not invested in health, and certainly not in the common good for health, to the extent that many other countries have decided to invest. And this, as you said, is a moral commitment, but it's also a political and an economic commitment to really invest resources into creating conditions that improve the outcomes of health for everyone.
Tell me more about the practice that you have of including not only, when you go into the field, students from the schools of medicine, nursing, pharmacy, but also veterinary medicine.
Well, we are really delighted to have a terrific school of veterinary medicine here at the University of Wisconsin. And when we formed the Center for Global Health, our deans of the health sciences got together and decided that it would be better if we did this collectively across the health sciences than individually, because there would be an economy of scale and we could learn from one another. Veterinarians, it turns out, are very holistic thinkers, because as they're working to improve the health of animals, they're thinking about what are the animals eating? What are the people who are feeding the animals? How are they ensuring their own livelihood? What are the environmental conditions that the animals are living in? And it turns out for much of the world, people and animals are living hand in hand, often in the same household or certainly on the same compound. And animals, goats and sheep, for instance, form a very large part of the income, the food source, the livelihood of many peoples around the world. So as we started working with the veterinarians, actually they taught us a concept called One Health. And that is the health of people and animals and the environment are absolutely interdependent. You can't really separate one from the other, because animals give us our food, the environment feeds both of us, and it's really all linked together. And so we owe our veterinarian colleagues a great deal of credit for teaching us to think in a much broader way than just the health of people alone, and that is it's people, animals, and the environment all linked together.
And that's become perfectly clear as we've dealt with diseases like SARS, like H1N1 flu.
Absolutely, and that's a perfect example, the H1N1, or also known as swine flu, of an illness that can rapidly move from animals to people and then quickly around the world. And it was phenomenal how a few cases in Mexico then spread to cases in Milwaukee and then 38, 40, 60 other countries around the world. And we're now actually looking at the specter of a very serious pandemic that could already be underway.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Dr. Hawk. Dr. Cynthia Hawk is our guest this hour, Director of the Center for Global Health, Professor of Family Medicine and Population Sciences at UW Medical School of Medicine and Public Health. She has trained village health workers in Uganda and many other countries in the world. She has worked extensively in other countries, also practiced in Belleville, Wisconsin, a town with less than 2,000 people, 20 miles outside of Madison. She spends a lot of time working to improve health care for medically disadvantaged populations, and she has been leading the effort here in Milwaukee to have urban health tracks for UW Medical students in cities, central cities. So she has a huge perspective on healthcare, and particularly healthcare for disadvantaged populations. Here's the number. Please join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you can do that, and that is talk@WPR.org. We've been doing a number of programs, as you know, on Tuesdays concerning healthcare, and one of the issues that has come up again and again is serving disadvantaged populations and how there are not enough doctors and nurses and veterinarians, perhaps, to serve some of the more remote locations, not only in Wisconsin, but also throughout the world. And we have yet to talk more about how it is that disease in other countries in the world has a direct impact here on people who live in Wisconsin and in the United States. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Tuesday, the co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. If you want to know how healthcare was dealt with in the administrations of FDR, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush, Bill Clinton, this is the hour you want to listen to. It is an exhaustive look at how those presidents dealt with health care, and some of the administrations may surprise you in how far they wanted to go in terms of health care reform. So that's our number two. We go to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Jean from Ashland, our first caller. Hello, Jean.
Hello. There's a website, very important website of several on the topic of solar cooking. It's solarcooking.org. It tells how to use the direct rays of the sun. You just multiply them by reflection or multiplying to cook food, sterilize water, or pasteurize water, and sterilize surgical instruments or bandages, whatever. And I never hear people talking when they talk about refugee camps and poor people everywhere. Many of them in countries where the sun is blasting and blazing down with a lot of heat just can be multiplied simply with very, very simple tools, even in indigenous materials of any country. And I never hear it talked about.
All right, Dr. Hawk, are you familiar with this?
Well, I am, and in fact, this is a wonderful new development that is actually spreading in many parts of the world to harness the power of solar energy, not only for purifying water and cooking food, but for all kinds of other energy resources. Much of the world does not have easy access to electrical power grids, but as you note, there's abundant solar energy coming down. The main challenge has been the technology for harnessing solar energy has been relatively expensive, even for those of us, many of us in the United States, to install solar panels. And so for a family living on $300 a year, buying a $100 solar oven is out of the question. So the challenge will be to harness these solar energy and make it very inexpensive and affordable for people in less economically developed countries. But I hope that, those technologies are on the horizon. Many are working very earnestly. Very simple method, just for putting bottles of water in the sun, is remarkably effective in killing most bacteria. So some of this is being done. It should be done more, and we hope to see this expanded rapidly in the future.
Thanks, Jean, for your call. Frank is next from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Really fine guest. I hope you both had a good holiday.
Yes, and you?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
I was interested, and I hope this isn't too obscure, in whether or not your guest would comment on the state of the new path, which several major medical schools in the United States started along, but aborted. And this was essentially patient-oriented medicine with an emphasis on general practice rather than specialization in the early years of medical education. And it had an earlier life and originated at the McMaster University Medical School in Ontario. And my feeling is that the drive towards HMO-based medicine in the United States, plus a certain perhaps self-interest on the part of the medical profession, led to the failure of such programs. But patient-centered medicine is something which, oddly enough, we don't really have. So I'll leave it there, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Frank, thank you for that question, and I think these are both really important areas that relate to health reform today. First of all, let me tell you that patient-centered medicine, at least the teaching of it, is alive and well here at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. It really is the cornerstone of our doctor-patient communication skill course. And the idea is that you start with understanding the patient. And if you don't take time to meet, understand, and know something about the background of the patient, a doctor, nurse, any health worker is going to be at a major disadvantage because patients come from a context of family, culture, and community. And so taking time to tap into that, to understand and acknowledge that, and also to use those resources that the patient brings is really critical, I believe, to the therapeutic impact of a physician. So we are still teaching it. It may not come across so much to patients, but I think the other problem we have, as you also touched on, is the lack of primary care physicians. That is, physicians who treat the whole patient, not just a particular organ system or a particular disease condition, but treat the whole patient. And in the United States, these are family doctors, general internists, and pediatricians who treat patients regardless of their condition. Now, what we have experienced here in the United States is a relative shortage of primary care physicians, and that has actually worsened over the last few decades. It used to be in the 1940s and 50s, most physicians were generalists, and then there was a very rapid increase in specialization and subspecialization, and guess what? It turns out that most subspecialists earn salaries 2, 3, 4 times higher than most primary care physicians. And I believe this was a very strong driving force in shifting the interests and motivations of young physicians away from general practice and into subspecialization, particularly technologically driven, procedure-oriented subspecialties where the incomes are much greater.
What's the answer to that? How do we get more primary care physicians?
Well, I think there are a few aspects. One is to select students who are more oriented towards generalist practice in the first place. And we know that there are some people come into medical school with a very strong interest in working with the whole patient, looking at the big picture, and others, by personality or orientation, are much more driven to look at the small parts. So part of it is the selection of students. The second part of it is what do we actually teach and value in the medical curriculum? And the third part of it, and this is perhaps the most important today, is what does the healthcare system reward? How is the system oriented to really support and encourage people to enter primary care careers? And right now there's a whole host of factors, from relatively lower salaries to more challenging working conditions, that tend to reduce students' interest in primary care rather than the other way.
We go next to, thanks very much, Frank, for your call as always, Vinay from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I had a question for your guest, and that was about alternative medicine and working with the World Health Organization. We're talking about medicine and medical practices and teaching. I get talking about I wanted to know the other one.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Vinay, your phone is just cutting out so badly that we can't hear you very well, so if you can get on another phone, we'd be happy to entertain your call. I want to talk a little bit more. You know, if you don't care about what's going on in the world, maybe you will care about what's happening in your own yard. You talk about the health of the people of Wisconsin being strongly affected by global trends, immigration, travel, trade, and shifting disease patterns. Can you spend more time on that? How has that changed the health picture in Wisconsin?
Well, let me use Milwaukee, where you are, Kathleen, as an example. This summer, we had a real strong increase in the number of H1N1 cases of influenza in Milwaukee.
Yes.
Schools were closed down. Businesses dropped. The economic sector was impacted. We have close to 200,000 people living in the central city of Milwaukee who have no health insurance. Now, let's look at the scenario of a major influenza pandemic occurring in the context of many people who don't have health insurance and are living relatively close together. And here we have a scenario in which even people who do have insurance are going to be negatively impacted and actually at increased risk, because we have a system that's so dysfunctional that many people who don't have insurance can't access care. And so that's just one example of travel, trade, immigration, and rapid spread of an infectious disease that can have disastrous consequences, not only for the people who don't have insurance, but for the whole industrial sector of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I don't know, 6-8 years ago when Tom Clark was still had a morning show on your station, he had a fellow on that that made a case that that the medical colleges were limiting enrollment. They were receiving subsidies at that time from Congress and from the government in order to subsidize the fact that they limited their enrollment. That was due to pressure from AMA. And the idea is supply and demand. If you have fewer doctors, they can charge more. But that was going on then. And I'm wondering, do you know if that's still going on? And that was at the Medical College of Wisconsin and at Madison.
Yes. Well, let me just say that there's no doubt that medical colleges do limit enrollment, and that indeed we could be training more physicians. And it's a very complex process. The training of a doctor takes a very long time and is quite expensive, and it turns out that it costs a lot more to educate a doctor than what any student would pay in terms of tuition. And so the rate of educating a doctor in the United States is probably, the cost of that might be upwards of a quarter of a million, $300,000 easily, okay? So part of this is a decision of how many doctors should we train, how many are needed, because it is costly to train doctors. There's no doubt we have many more well-qualified applicants to medical schools across the country than we have positions. Now, realizing this, actually, all of the medical schools, or many of them in the United States, are increasing their enrollment, and there are actually a number of new medical schools being built to try to increase the capacity and training and graduation rates of physicians in the United States. There's a worldwide shortage of doctors. On the other hand, the more doctors you train, the more the health system costs, because doctors tend to be more costly and generate more cost for the system than would, for instance, a nurse or a medical assistant. And so part of the question is not just how many doctors do you need, but how many health workers in total do you need, and what's the right skill mix, and how can you get the right mix of skills in the sufficient numbers of people and then get them geographically distributed in such a way that everyone has access to well-trained health workers. It turns out that's a really complicated problem to solve. A few governments of the world have done a pretty good job of it. Most have not. And in most countries of the world, you're going to see a relative shortage of health workers in rural areas and in urban areas of poverty, where the living conditions and working conditions are more challenging, and doctors and health workers make less money.
Right. So what do we do about that? I know that you've spent a number of years working in Belleville, 20 miles outside of Madison. You work with a lot of people in rural communities, with farmers, et cetera. We hear all the time about shortages in those parts of this state and around the country. What do we do about that in the urban areas as well, where we are?
Well, the wonderful thing that we know is that there are things that can be done to change the equation, because there are countries that have done it, Australia, for example. And what Australia did is they found that if you want to have rural doctors, guess what? You go to rural communities and find bright young people who want to go to medical school, and then you develop programs to make it easier for them to get into medical school and to stay connected with working with rural communities as they progress through their training. Then you provide incentives to bring them back, make it easy for them to set up practice, to raise a family, to find good schools for their children, jobs for their spouses. All those things incentivize the chances that physicians and or nurses, other health workers, will practice in rural areas. That is, if they come from those areas to begin with, they're much more likely to go back. Although, surprisingly, you have some urban residents who are very anxious to get into the countryside, and so you make opportunities for them, too. Here at our school, the School of Medicine and Public Health in Wisconsin, we have a special program called WARM, the Wisconsin Academy of Rural Medicine, that is doing very similar to what I described in Australia. We're finding people who are interested in rural practice. We're training them in rural areas as they progress through medical school, and that highly increases the likelihood that they will go back, especially if we can develop loan repayment programs and job placement programs to make it easy for them to find jobs in areas that they're interested in. Likewise, in the central city, we've developed a new program called TRIUMPH, the Training in Urban Medicine and Public Health in central Milwaukee. We have more medical students here in Madison who want to come into Milwaukee than what we have space for now.
Really?
So it's a great problem. Students are very interested in serving disadvantaged populations. It gives them a sense of meaning and purpose and reward that is different than, and in some cases far more important than, financial reward. And that is working in an area where the need is great, the appreciation is deep, and you know you're making a difference in people's lives.
Right. Yeah. It's important work. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Cynthia Hawk is our guest, director of the Center for Global Health, a professor of family medicine and population sciences at UW Medical School of Medicine and Public Health. She also has been very, very instrumental in establishing an urban health track for UW medical students. So she practices in Madison and in Milwaukee and in Belleville, Wisconsin, which is a town with less than 2,000 people. She has taken students all over the world to work for people in those communities who are disadvantaged, and they take on the whole of public health, which includes, as we've discovered this hour, a lot. Here's the email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And again, the phone number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Tuesday, we'll speak with the co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. The guests have visited the archives of all the presidents since FDR, and they have looked at health care. And they have done this because because we're involved in this huge health care debate right now. And they also say that this particular issue tests presidents' ideas, heart, luck, allies, and their skill at running the most complicated government machinery in the world. So what kinds of reforms did each of those presidents try to enact? What was successful? What wasn't? Were there major differences between Democrats and Republicans? You'll be surprised by some of what they have found. And also maybe not surprised that this debate has gone on for a long, long time with a lot of the same rhetoric. Another reminder that tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, there will be live coverage of President Obama's primetime address to Congress. As you know, the president will be talking about his plans for the nation's healthcare system. It's a much anticipated address, and we welcome you to listen to that here tomorrow night at 7 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for our guest. And let's go next to Mary from Janesville. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I just recently completed a course as a master gardener through the University of Wisconsin Extension. And I was lucky enough to meet a whole bunch of people who are into food safety, food sustainability, and gardening. And I guess my question for your guest would be, how much educational opportunity is there for people to actually teach disadvantaged groups of people how to help improve their health by improving their diet by growing fresh fruits and vegetables? And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, Mary, thanks very much for the call.
Comment, and I'm delighted you asked, because one of the thrills of our Triumph program in Milwaukee was discovering a great program called Growing Power under the leadership of Will Allen and another community development organization, Walnut Way, led by Sharon and Larry Adams, to do just this, and that is to transform what's an urban oasis of healthy food into abundant, locally produced organic food and healthy lifestyle in the central city. So our medical students were initially a bit puzzled as to why we were visiting gardens and worm and compost piles, but very quickly realized that if you don't eat well, that's the foundation of a healthy lifestyle. And often in many central city areas, you can't even buy healthy food. And yet there are vacant lots sitting ready and ripe for growing gardens if only you had the skills and resources to do so. So I'm delighted to see a resurgence of urban gardening in Milwaukee, in Madison, and many other urban sites in the country. Of course, in rural areas, gardening often remains a common standard of life, but there are issues about gardening in the rural areas or the agricultural sector where there are additional risks from pesticides and so forth that are very important. So I think there's a growing awareness of the fundamental importance of healthy food for health, and how we raise our food, how it's transported, sustainable agriculture. That's really coming into the health sector now as a new dimension of promoting health and well-being.
Well, it is amazing to me when you talk about healthy eating in central cities. I drive through Central City, Milwaukee, a lot, and there just aren't any stores. It's all convenience stores. It's all liquor stores. There aren't any grocery stores.
Absolutely. And this is where the concept of the urban oasis came in. You can actually go for several miles in each direction in the central city of Milwaukee and not find a grocery store that's selling fresh fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is beginning to change, again, with the work of Growing Power and other groups, to try and not only raise food in Milwaukee, but then to stock it in local shops, and more importantly, perhaps, to raise awareness of the importance of healthy eating, to help people rediscover how fine fresh food tastes, how it can be prepared in a way that's culturally acceptable, but still healthy and economically feasible, affordable for people in these areas. So there's a lot of work going on, and this is very important.
Let's go next to Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. One of my comments is a lot of the doctors that go into the specialties hop right from physician school to their specialty school. Is what they need to do is, before you can enter a specialty, you have to do 5 years as a GP. That would increase the number of GPs in the United States. And second of all, to get them to work in the rural areas and the underprivileged areas, they would get reimbursed by clinics that are specially targeted, where they'd have to work to get reimbursed for their education.
Tom, this is a really great suggestion, and in fact, many countries in the world do require the exact type of service commitment that you are suggesting. This is common in many, many countries, and there are some good things about it. That is, you have a steady supply of young doctors moving into areas of shortage for service and to learn themselves. The downside of this type of an arrangement is that oftentimes these doctors are ill-suited. They're not necessarily motivated to be in these areas, and they're not necessarily well-trained to be a comprehensive primary care physician. So their attitudes may not be the best, and as soon as the service commitment is finished, they rapidly leave, and the local communities then are served by a whole rotation of short-term doctors who don't really want to be there. So that's the downside of this arrangement. Nevertheless, it is a strategy to get doctors working in perhaps less attractive areas. I do believe that the countries that have invested in longer-term solutions to select and train doctors to work long-term in these areas is really beneficial. My work in Belleville for nearly 20 years was so fantastic. I took care of five generations of the same family, delivered the babies, took care of the old ones at home as they were dying. And I'll tell you, it was just an absolutely phenomenal experience. I wouldn't trade anything in the world for that long-term experience with families in a community.
Yeah.
And these short-term arrangements are not quite the same in terms of developing the same depth of relationship and continuity of care.
What about the students that you work with who you take to the field in Thailand and Ecuador and Uganda and various places? Do you find, have you tracked them? Do you find that they do a different kind of care, that they become primary care physicians?
Well, some of the students who go are oriented towards primary care in the first place.
Yes.
Many of our courses have a primary care focus. So it's kind of hard to say the chicken and egg. You know, we attract students who are more interested, by and large, in primary care. And I think many of them, it reinforces their commitment that this type of practice is interesting, rewarding, and it makes a very big difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Even for patients or for students who are interested in subspecialty practice, I think the opportunity of living and working in a less economically developed country changes their perspective. They come back with a deeper appreciation of the importance of a person's family and culture and context on their ability to adhere to any type of medical care or diet or procedure that requires complex treatment. And so I think any student of health who goes to a different culture, they come back and they see their own culture a little bit differently. And they appreciate a lot more of the subtle things that go on that we often take for granted and don't pay attention to. But in a person's, in the time of illness or death or dysfunction, these factors can make a very big difference in a person's life.
Yes. Thank you, Tom, for your call. Joanne is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne. Or Joan it is. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about a comparison of how we don't consider dental health and prevention part of our health care system in the United States. Is it like that elsewhere? Because it's totally illogical. And somebody told me it was historical, that the long ago the Doctors Association didn't want dental health to be considered health or part of the medical field. And
Joan, this is a really important question, and it's puzzled me for many years. I don't understand myself why there's such a separation between dental health and the rest of one's body. It's kind of like the separation of mental health from biomedical problems. For many years, mental health was considered in a separate category. It all connects together. So I think you're right. There were historical, political, probably economic decisions that were made to separate this out. And in fact, in many countries of the world, dental health is not well addressed. Even in Canada, that we hear so much about their national health program, dental health is not covered or not covered to the same degree as the rest of the healthcare system. And so in many countries, this is neglected. But we are learning more and more about how one's dental health, the state of the gums, the bacteria, the cleaning of the teeth, can actually increase your risk of heart disease and all kinds of other problems. And so it doesn't make any sense, but it's a serious problem, and in fact one of the biggest unmet health care needs in the United States is that of dental care.
Thanks, June, for the call. Mary Ann from Madison. Hi.
Good morning, Cynthia. Our link is Arboretum Co-Housing here in Madison. The question I have for you is the statistic that's thrown around of the United States in first world countries being 37th in health outcome and 19th in infant mortality. One, how is that statistic, those two statistics, arrived at? And two, why does the United States rank that low as a first world country?
Marianne, thanks for your question. This is a fantastic question, and it really illustrates how sad it is that despite the fact that the United States spends more money than any other country in the world, our health outcomes are not as good. We're ranking, according to the World Health Organization, 37th in healthcare outcomes overall. That puts together lots of different measures that we probably don't have time to get into, but basically we spend more and we get less. Partly this is because we've got 47 million who are uncovered without health care insurance. Therefore, they're less likely to seek primary health care, to get their immunizations, to get their hypertension or diabetes treated. They're more likely to land up in the hospital, emergency rooms, or intensive care unit in a crisis when things could have been prevented and treated at much lower cost if we had a more rational system. In terms of infant mortality, we continue to have one of the highest rates of teenage pregnancy in the industrialized world, this goes back to all kinds of both social and cultural taboos about talking about sexuality and birth control. We with young people. So we have very high teenage pregnancy rates, premature birth rates, and high infant mortality, 5 times higher in Milwaukee than in Madison. This is unbelievable and really a marker of the failure of our health care system to really do what we expect it to do.
In 15 seconds, we only have that left. What do you think the chances are of significant health care reform in the next few months?
Well, let me say we need health care reform. I don't think we have an option to continue with the status quo. There's more momentum now and more public will behind change. There's more political will and there's more professional consensus that the current system is broken. Finding solutions that are going to make everyone happy will be impossible, but I believe we don't have an option not to change.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Hawk. Dr. Cynthia Hawk, Director of the Center for Global Health, Professor of Family Medicine, Population Sciences at UW Medical School of Medicine and Public Health. She has worked with students in the field in developing countries all over the world and works in Madison and in Milwaukee as well. We thank her. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production. News ahead, and we'll return on the Ideas Net.